So last week, I talked about the birth of our youngest daughter and how that was not planned. And as we went on with that, I talked about how, she figured out when she was about 12 that she was not planned. And what she did was she says, "Yeah, Dad, I know I'm a mistake." And my response to that has always been, "Well, I always make the best of my mistakes, so you're okay." And she's kind of gotten used to that. But you know, there's a lot of folks who believe that all births are accidental, that, you know, we're not really planned. Lots of people think that there's no purpose in existence. We're all just random acts of nature. So you might as well party, you know, eat, drink, and misbehave because you're going to die tomorrow. But that just doesn't make any sense. You know, I like to remind people that death is imminent. That's going to happen to all of us. I said that at a baccalaureate once, and about 15 years ago or so, and people are still remembering it because, it's reality. Eat, drink, and misbehave tomorrow, because tomorrow we're going to die. But that really doesn't make any sense. You know, and what if it's not true? One of my favorite conversations with unbelievers is that, well, what if you're wrong? What if your life was carefully planned in the mind of God? What if He made you for a specific reason? You're not an accident. You've been planned from all eternity, and you are not based on the random selection of nature. One of the best things I've read on this subject is this book by Rick Warren, What on Earth Am I Here For? That's the second title. It started off with The Purpose-Driven Life, but he revised it and changed the title. It's one of the best things I've ever read on the subject. If you're going to read one book for the rest of your life, I'd read this one because it's that good. Now, what he does in this book is he talks about how our lives are carefully planned by God. And he describes life in three ways. He says the Bible offers us three metaphors that teach us God's view of life. Life is a test, life is a trust, and life is a temporary assignment. And that's kind of a cool way of looking at things. You know, everything in this life is kind of a test. God is building our character. And our character is the only thing we get to take with us when we die. It's, you know, who we are. And that's being built up by all the tests that this life can throw at us. It's also a trust in that God entrusts us with material resources, gives us savings accounts. He gives us the ability to earn. He gives us our wages. He gives us talents that we can use. He gives us opportunities to improve ourselves in all things. He constantly is blessing us. Opportunities to improve our situations all the time. So life is a trust, and it's also a temporary assignment. It's going to end. Your life is just a tiny, tiny part of eternity. There's lots and lots of things going to happen when you're not around. So set yourself up with eternal values, knowing that everything in this life has a limited shelf life, and it really does. But the fact is that God has planned us, each one of us. Your birthday is on God's calendar. He carefully arranged it, and he gives you free will. If you want, you can throw this life away. If you want, you can waste it, or you can use it for God's purposes. You can represent Jesus if you want to. But the thing that I want you to remember today is that we are not overdeveloped protoplasm. You know, we were carefully planned in the mind of God. We are the crown of God's creation. And we realize that when bad things happen to us, it's just a test. Things happen to us that we don't like, it's a test. And we have to realize that it will pass. Yeah, you know, it's like the news this week has been really big about the flooding in Texas and the 27 little girls who died in a Bible camp, of all things. That's tragic. Nature does some awful things. That was no one's fault. And I can't imagine the grief that the parents are going through right now. But that flood in Texas is a test. Not just for those people there, it's a test for us too. How are we going to respond to it? Are we going to pray for them? Are we going to offer help? What are we going to do about it? How we respond to it is a test. That's a huge test that everyone knows about. But small tests come to us too all the time. I had a small test this week because Hudsonville ice cream came on sale at Meijer again. And you know, I can eat a carton in one sitting, sometimes more than a carton. Good thing it never shows on me. But you know, the thing is that's a test. I didn't buy any. Every Sunday morning is a test. I don't feel like going to church today. Well, you have to, you're the pastor. Oh, okay. But you think about that, you know, every Sunday morning is a test. How many more Sunday mornings is the Lord going to give me? How many more Sunday mornings is he going to give you? Now, in the book of the prophet Jeremiah, there's a lot of testing going on. This week, we're going to look at tests for Jeremiah, Zedekiah, and Nebuchadnezzar. And we learn that testing can be unpleasant. We also learn that testing is only temporary. So let's take a look at Jeremiah 32 and see how the Lord intends to return things to normal after the test. Passage reads like this. The following message came to Jeremiah from the Lord in the 10th year of the reign of Zedekiah, king of Judah. This was also the 18th year of the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar. So here Jeremiah gets a message from God. That's a test, especially for Jeremiah. What's he going to do with it? You know, Jeremiah, at the time of this part of the book, is already in jail because he irritated Zedekiah, who was this puppet king that Nebuchadnezzar put in place. You know, as Zedekiah was one of Nebuchadnezzar's cronies, and he just put him on the throne instead of the rightful king, the descendant of David. So he's in jail for irritating this king. Now, all the other prophets are telling this king, oh, just think positive. Everything's going to be all right. In the meantime, the biggest army in the world is surrounding Jerusalem. They can't eat. They can't offer their sacrifices in the temple. You know, they offered sheep every day. You like sheep, right? And the thing is, they were running out of sheep because they couldn't bring any food in. So they were starving to death. And these prophets are all saying, oh, it's going to be great. Everything's wonderful. You'll be able to defeat Nebuchadnezzar. Well, Zedekiah's army compared to Nebuchadnezzar's army was just a small thing. It'd be like if the country of Belize tried to take on the American army. There's just no comparison. They can't do it. But Jeremiah had his free will. Now, he could have kept quiet. He didn't have to tell anybody this message. And if he had kept quiet, he would have stayed out of jail. And, of course, more people would have died. And King Zedekiah, he was tested too. He could have listened to Jeremiah, but he didn't. Now he was too busy being a puppet king under Nebuchadnezzar. And the book of Jeremiah tells us that in his end days, he decided to rebel. He decided to listen to those false prophets and rebel against Nebuchadnezzar. So Nebuchadnezzar comes down to Jerusalem, and he sees Zedekiah's four sons. And right in front of Zedekiah, he executes those four boys, puts them to the sword. And then he blinds Zedekiah, takes a hot coal and blinds his eyes because he said, the last thing you're going to see is your sons dying. Nebuchadnezzar was not a nice person, as you can gather. But, you know, he paid a high price for it. Now, Nebuchadnezzar is an interesting guy, too. He was a horrible guy. You know, the purpose of Nebuchadnezzar, God called him to be a world ruler. And the purpose of the government is always to protect the sheep from the wolves. But Nebuchadnezzar fed the sheep to the wolves. He became a wolf himself. God called him to be a shepherd. And instead, he used the might of Babylon, the biggest army in the world at the time, to help the wolves kill the sheep. And of course, he ended up being a wolf himself. He paid a price for it too. If you read the book of Daniel, Nebuchadnezzar went insane for 7 years, ate grass, didn't cut his hair or anything like that. And then his insanity left him. And as the passage says, once he regained his sanity, he acknowledged the Lord. And he started protecting the sheep from the wolves. But in the meantime, he didn't. So the narrative continues like this. Jerusalem was then under siege from the Babylonian army, and Jeremiah was imprisoned in the courtyard of the guard in the royal palace. King Zedekiah had put him there, asking why he kept giving this prophecy. This is what the Lord says. I'm about to hand this city over to the king of Babylon, and he will take it. So Jeremiah's in prison. And Zedekiah put him there because of what he said. The Lord's going to hand Jerusalem over to Nebuchadnezzar because Jerusalem, called by God to be an example to the rest of the world, started, you know, helping the wolves eat the sheep. They were not protecting the sheep from the wolves, so they had to pay for it. The narrative continues like this. Jeremiah said, God's message came to me like this. Prepare yourself. Hanamel, your uncle Shalom's son, is on his way to see you. He's going to say, buy my field in Anathoth. You have the legal right to buy it. Now, Anathoth, that's a strange name. And you know, in Hebrew, the tau, the T, can be a TH if they put a little dot in the center of it. And it's really hard to distinguish that. I'd been calling it Anatote all these years, but it's Anathoth. And you might think this is an odd passage to be inserted here, but it was a message from God for a reason. It's a metaphor with dual meanings. See, and in those days, if you were related to someone, you had the first chance to buy their property when they sold it. You still had to pay market price, but you had the first chance to buy it. So like if I'd sell my house, my siblings would have the first right to buy it under the law of the land of those days. And it was just the law. And the passage goes on, and sure enough, just as God had said, my cousin Hanamel came to me while I was in jail and said, buy my field in Anathoth in the territory of Benjamin, for you have the legal right to keep it in the family. Buy it. Take it over. That did it. I knew it was God's message. This is strange, but it's not impossible. So I bought the field in Anathoth for my cousin Hanamel. I paid him 17 silver shekels. I followed all the proper procedures in the presence of witnesses. I wrote out the bill of sale, sealed it, and weighed out the money on the scales. Then I took the deed of purchase, the sealed copy that contained the contract and its conditions, and also the open copy, and gave them to Baruch, son of Neriah, son of Messiah. They didn't use last names. You were just the son of whoever you were the son of, and that's how you were identified. All this took place in the presence of my cousin Hanamel and the witnesses who had signed the deed, as the Jews who were in the jail that day looked on. So he had plenty of witnesses, and then he says, then in front of them all, I told Baruch, these are the orders from God of the angel armies, the God of Israel. Take these documents, both the sealed and the open deeds, put them for safekeeping in a pottery jar. For God of the angel armies, the God of Israel, says, life is going to return to normal. Homes and fields and vineyards are again going to be bought in this country. See, the big test was coming. They were going to be exiled for 70 years. The nobility, the upper class of the people of Jerusalem, all their sons were neutered so they wouldn't reproduce. They didn't want the Jews to have any kids. But they were being tested. See, because the trust that God had given them was violated. They were entrusted with political leadership to protect the sheep from the wolves, but they didn't do it. That was the whole purpose of the Davidic government, just to look out for the little guy. They refused to do it. So their test was coming. And the test would be temporary. It's a temporary assignment. It lasted 70 years. So how do you respond to 70 years of testing? Well, you make the best of it. I had a buddy back in Iowa who did foster parenting. And several of the foster kids that he took in went to school with me. And one of them had robbed a local farmer's co-op. He'd stole some tires. And he had to go to jail. And what this guy said to him was, make sure you're a better man when you come out of jail than when you went in. Use this time to make yourself better. It's his response to a test. Well, bad things happen. You know, the floods in Texas, I can't imagine what that's like. I used to live in a floodplain in Oklahoma, and I couldn't buy flood insurance. I lived in a trailer court, in a little trailer that... You know, I had to put straps around it because it was also Tornado Alley. I had to anchor it down, but I could not buy flood insurance for it because it was on a floodplain. One out of every 11 years, that area flooded. It didn't flood while I was living there, but that was a test. You know, these people are really being tested in Texas right now. And there's folks all around that are being tested. You know, I talked to a guy with cancer already this morning. He's just got a couple of months left. Talk to people who are going through divorce, who are going through unemployment. It's all devastating stuff. No matter how tragic it is, everything can be used to make us better people. You can't control outside external events. None of us can. But we can control our response to it. I like the illustration of surfers, and I can honestly tell you I have never surfed, and I don't intend to start. But you know, it's interesting to me. If you watch it, I've watched it on TV, and I've been to California a couple of times and seen people doing this. But you know, the surfers cannot control the waves. The waves just come. They can only control their response to them. They can get on those surfboards. I don't know why anybody would do this, but they get on those surfboards and ride, you know, it doesn't appeal to me at all, but they do respond to the waves. Can't control them. None of us can. But we have a helper, and that's the important thing. If you're going to get anything from Jeremiah at all, it's that optimism in the face of devastation is possible when you trust Jesus. You know, when I was in seminary, we had a lot of testing that took place, and the tests always have time limits on them. Usually it was an hour and a half. And you get these miserable little blue books, and the professor would put three questions on the chalkboard. Nobody has chalkboards anymore, but they put three questions up. You picked one, and you had an hour and a half to answer it from memory. You couldn't have any notes. You know, of course, there were no cell phones in those days that you could quick go online and cheat, you know. But, that's how that went. The important thing is, the reason I'm telling this story is that the time of testing always passed. Sooner or later, you had to turn your little blue book in with your answers in it. Now, I like that kind of a test because you just write down whatever you could think of, and it usually turned out pretty good for us. The importance of this chapter of Jeremiah is his insistence that things will turn back to normal. No matter what kind of a test you're going through right now, no matter how nasty things can get, things will return to normal. So then Jeremiah's message to you and I is, make wise choices when you're being tested. Immeasurable blessings will be yours when you do. Make those good choices. And let's believe this good news and live in peace. Would you pray with me, please? Lord, help us to hear the words of Jeremiah, to know that it is your desire to return things to normal after the time of testing. We look forward to that, and we place our faith in you. So we're seeking your blessing, especially during our times of testing. Amen.